Chapter 5, The Fall of Babylon. Before this first impact of the Mosaic Law could be felt by other peoples came the event of 536 BC, which set the pattern of the 20th century AD, the fall of Babylon. The resemblance between the pattern of events today, that is to say, the shape taken by the outcome of the two world wars and that of the fall of Babylon, is too great to be accidental, and in fact can now be shown to have been deliberately produced. The peoples of the West in the present century, had they realized it, were governed under the Judaic law, not under any law of their own, by the forces that control governments. The grouping of characters in the final denouement are alike in all three cases. On one side of the stage is the foreign potentate who has oppressed and affronted the Judahites, or, today, the Jews. In Babylon this was King Belshazzar. In the First World War it was the Russian Tsar. In the Second War, it was Hitler. Confronting this persecutor is the other foreign potentate, the Liberator. In Babylon, this was King Cyrus of Persia. In the second case, it was a Mr. Balfour. In the third, it was a President Truman. Between these adversaries stands the Jehovah Prophet Triumphant, the great man at the foreign ruler's court who foretells, and survives, the disaster which is about to befall the persecutor. In Babylon, this was Daniel. In the First and Second World Wars of this century, it was a Dr. Chaim Weizmann, the Zionist prophet at foreign courts. These are the characters. Then comes the denouement, a Jehovah vengeance on the heathen and a Jewish triumph in the form of a symbolic restoration. King Belshazzar, when Daniel has foretold his doom, is killed in the same night and his kingdom falls to the enemy. The Jewish captors who killed the Russian Tsar and his family at the end of the first 20th century war quoted this precedent in a couplet written on the wall of the room where the massacre occurred. The Nazi leaders at the end of the second 20th century war were hanged on the Jewish Day of Atonement. Thus the two world wars of this century have conformed, in their outcomes, to the pattern of the Babylonian-Persian War of antiquity as depicted in the Old Testament. Presumably the peoples who fought that ancient war thought that something more than the cause of the Judahites was at stake, and that they strove for some purpose or interest of their own. But in the narrative that has come down through the centuries, all else has been expunged. The only significant results, in the picture which has been imprinted on the minds of peoples, are the Jehovah vengeance and Judahite triumph, and the two world wars of this century follow that same pattern. King Belshazzar survives only as the symbolic foreign persecutor of the Judahites, although Jehovah made them his captives, as a punishment, he is nevertheless their persecutor and hence must be barbarously destroyed. King Cyrus, similarly, is but a fulfilling instrument of Jehovah's promise to visit all these curses on thine enemies when they have served their turn as captors, and thus deserves no credit in his own right, either as conqueror or liberator. He is not truly any better than King Belshazzar, and his house will in turn be destroyed. King Cyrus, from what true history tells of him, seems to have been an enlightened man, as well as the founder of an empire which spread over all Western Asia. According to the encyclopedias, he left the nations he subjected free in the observance of their religions and the maintenance of their institutions. Thus, the Judahites may have benefited by a policy which he impartially applied to all, and possibly King Cyrus, could he return to earth today, would be surprised to find that his portrait in history is that of a man whose only notable and enduring achievement was to restore a few thousand Judahites to Jerusalem. However, if by any chance he thought this particular question to be of paramount importance among his undertakings, as the 20th century politicians demonstrably think, he would at his return to earth today be much gratified. For he would find that through this act he exerted a greater influence on human events in the 2,500 years to come, probably than any other temporal ruler of any age. No other deed of antiquity has had consequences in the present time so great or so plain to trace. in the 20th century AD, two generations of Western politicians, in the quest for Jewish favor, competed with each other to play the part of King Cyrus. The result was that the two world wars produced only two enduring and significant results, the Jehovah's vengeance on the symbolic persecutor and the Jewish triumph in the form of a new restoration. Thus the symbolic legend of what happened at Babylon had by the 20th century gained the force of the supreme law, overriding all other laws, and of truth and history. The legend itself seems to have been two-thirds untruth, or what today would be called propaganda. King Belshazzar himself was apparently invented by the Levites. The historical book which records the fall of Babylon was compiled several centuries later and was attributed to one Daniel. It states that he was a Judahite captive in Babylon who rose to the highest place at court there and sat in the gate of the king Nebuchadnezzar through his skill in interpreting dreams. Upon him devolved the task of interpreting the writing on the wall, Daniel 5. King Belshazzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, is then depicted as offering an insult to the Judahites by using the golden and silver vessels taken by his father from the temple in Jerusalem for a banquet with his princes, wives and concubines. There on the fingers of a man's hand write on the wall the words, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Daniel, being called to interpret, tells the king that they mean, God hath numbered thy kingdom, and finished it. Thou art weighed in the balance and found wanting. Thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Thereon King Belshazzar, in the same night, is slain, and the Persian conqueror enters, who is to restore the Judahites. Thus the end of a king and a kingdom is related directly to an affront offered to Judah and given the guise of a Jehovah retribution and Jewish vengeance. What matter if Daniel and King Belshazzar never existed? By its inclusion in the Levitical scriptures, this anecdote gained the status of a legal precedent. When the murder of the Russian Tsar, his wife, daughters and son in 1918, again, was related directly to this legend by words quoted from it and scrawled on a blood-bespattered wall. This was at once an avowal of authorship of the deed, and a citation of the legal authority for it. When an ancient legend can produce such effects, 25 centuries afterwards, there is little gain in demonstrating its untruth, for politicians and the masses they manipulate alike love their legends more than truth. However, of the three protagonists in this version of the fall of Babylon, only King Cyrus certainly existed. King Belshazzar and Daniel seem to be figures of Levitical fantasy. The Jewish Encyclopedia, which points out that King Nebuchadnezzar had no son called Belshazzar and that no king called Belshazzar reigned in Babylon when King Cyrus conquered it, says impartially that the author of Daniel simply did not have correct data at hand, and thus does not believe that Daniel wrote Daniel. Obviously, if an important Judahite favored at court, called Daniel, had written a book, he would at least have known the name of the king whose end he foretold, and thus have had correct data. Evidently the book of Daniel, like the books of the law attributed to Moses, was the product of Levitical scribes who in it patiently continued to make history conform with their law, already laid down. If a King Belshazzar could be invented for the purpose of illustration and precedent, so could a prophet Daniel. This apparently mythical Daniel is the most popular prophet of all, with the fervent Zionists of today, who rejoice in the anecdote of the Judahite vengeance and triumph foretold on the wall, and see in it the legal precedent for all later time. The story of our present century has done more than that of any earlier one to strengthen them in this belief, and for them Daniel, with his interpretation fulfilled in the same night, gives the conclusive, crushing answer to the earlier Israelite prophets who had envisioned the loving God of all men. The fall of Babylon, as depicted by the Levites, gave practical proof of the truth and force of the Mosaic Law. However, it would all have come to nothing without King Cyrus, who alone of the three protagonists did exist and did either allow, or compel, a few thousand Judahites to return to Jerusalem. At that point in history, the Levitical theory of politics, which aimed at the exercise of power through the acquirement of mastery over foreign rulers, was put to its first practical test and was successful. The Persian king was the first of a long line of Gentile oracles worked by the ruling sect, which through him demonstrated that it had found the secret of infesting, first, and then directing the actions of foreign governments. By the present century, this mastery of governments had been brought to such a degree of power that they were all, in large measure, under one supreme control, so that their actions, in the end, always serve the ambition of this supreme party. Towards the end of this book, the reader will see how the Gentile oracles were worked, so that the antagonisms of peoples might be incited and brought into collision for this supernational purpose. However, the reader will need to look into his own soul to find, if he can, the reason why these oracles, his own leaders, submitted. King Cyrus was the first of them. Without his support, the sect could not have set itself up again in Jerusalem and have convinced the incredulous Judahite masses, watching from all parts of the known world, that the racial law was potent and would be literally fulfilled. The line of cause and effect runs straight and clear from the fall of Babylon to this century's great events. The West today owes its successive disappointments and its decline even more to King Cyrus, the first of the Gentile puppets, than to the ingenious, stealthy priesthood itself. Judaism originated in the name of the Persian king and by the authority of his empire, and thus the effect of the empire of the Achaemenids extends with great power, as almost nothing else, directly into our present age, says Professor Edward Mayer, and this authority's conclusion is demonstrably true. 500 years before the West even began, the Levites laid down the law, and then through King Cyrus set the precedent and pattern for the downfall of the West itself. The five books of the law were still not complete when King Cyrus came to Babylon and conquered. The sect in Babylon was still busy on them and on the supporting version of history which, by such examples as that of King Belshazzar, was to give plausibility to the unbelievable and supply the precedent for barbaric deeds 25 centuries later. The mass of Judahites still knew nothing of the law of racial intolerance which was being prepared for them, though religious intolerance was by this time familiar to them. The sect had yet to complete the law and then to apply it to its own people. When that happened in 458 BC, under another Persian king, the controversy of Zion at last took the shape in which it still implacably confronts its own people and the rest of mankind. The umbilical cord between the Judahites and other men was then finally severed. These segregated people, before whom the priesthood flaunted its version of the fall of Babylon like a banner, then were set on the road to a future which would find them a compact force among other peoples, to whose undoing they were by their law dedicated.